All right, well, folks, welcome to, this is day two, full day of Link Conference, and this is afternoon two. More importantly, it's the afternoon that follows that night before. Depending on what activities you had, you might be a little bit tired, and so slipping into a post-lunch food coma right about now. I'm gonna try to keep you engaged as much as possible. I did see some folks walking around that looked like they felt like a bag of smashed apples, so I'm assuming for some people it was a long night. Hopefully for those of you guys here, you're dedicated and here for as much of the material as possible. So welcome. We're going to get going here in just a second. I do want to get to know a bit about my audience, though. How many of you guys have actually been to Vegas before? Really? All right, so who hasn't been to Vegas before? All right, so I'm in the minority group here. It's interesting. For a guy with ADD, this is definitely an interesting city for me. A lot of shiny, flashy things to catch my attention and distract me. Gonna try to stay focused here, but I just have to say this is a very normal looking crowd compared to what I've seen in the city since I've gotten here. I've seen, I think, a Wookiee, two stormtroopers, Darth Vader twins, a guy out front actually at the Aria with this enormous cranium and a robe. I think he's supposed to be like a Roswell alien, not product group. I'm happy to have a group of the normal folks here. And you're here because you're focused specifically on Link, hopefully conferencing. And so what we're gonna do is get into a little bit about this. This is a 300 level session. So for those of you who are wanting to know who I am and trying to figure out if this is the session for you, I'll start off with the introduction. My name's Mark Perez. I'm an architect, specifically working in our CTO office for Premier. So what that means is I'm trying to help define and refine our support offerings for customers and for partners, and then of course engaging directly with customers in the where do they go from here dialogue and decision. So that's a lot of process, a lot of work to make sure people have what's sound, they deploy what's sound, and they move forward and extend something that is truly extensible and supported. So I do come from the, I'm new to this role from MCS, done a lot of solution architecture work. So very excited to talk about the bowels of this, if you will, and get into some of the guts. And we will get into a 300 level where we're talking about URL shipping, cracking the a meeting URI, trying to understand how we actually get to a conference ID, what the join process is like. We'll talk about Office Web App Server, what it does, how it streams, what some of our considerations are there. So hopefully that's what you're signed up for. So you got the intro about me. Who here is already running? Who here is running Link 2010? Okay, who's running Link 2013? Those running 2013, are you doing conferencing? And I mean, out, you know, there's Enterprise Voice, dial-in, the full thing. Okay, so you guys can go, right? Hopefully, you're here because you're looking to make sure you've got things in the right place. Who here's never done Link? So they haven't got a Link deployment yet? All right, so let me just level set. What we'll do is, actually, let me get to the agenda. That will help you get a better sense of what I'm talking about here. So this is the agenda. We are going to start off with a short demo. It's a high-level demo. I'm going to take a look at just at things from an administrative point of view. What does our deployment process look like in the early stages at a high level? So if you're here for the higher-level stuff, you know, the 300 material, just be patient for a second. We won't spend a lot of time there. But it's important, because when we're talking about conferencing, our objective as Microsoft is to make sure you understand that, yes, we have a lot in the product, we are offering a lot of fairly sophisticated and under the hood some complicated things, but to deploy it is a far simpler task than some of these 300 level sessions or 400 level sessions might lead you to believe. So what we don't want to do is scare off the folks who are looking at adopting something like Link as a conferencing solution by showing them all the bowels and not showing them, well, roughly here's how you set something like this up and deploy it. So we'll start off there. And hopefully that's a fair place to begin. So we'll take a look at the deployment wizard. We'll take a quick look at Topology Builder. And mostly to do that, to level set you on the process for deployment, but also as a reference. So when I start talking a little bit more in detail about some of the URL shipping, simple URLs, managing multiple SIP domains. It's gonna be important that those folks who aren't so familiar with this process know where they could have defined those, where they could get themselves in trouble. So that's where we'll start. Then we'll move on to clients. That's a short bit where I'm going to describe a little bit about the clients that are out there. Most of this should be old hat for you. You guys saw the keynote. You know what's coming. I do want to make sure we're clear about what's conferencing-centric that exists today. That's already shipped, that's tried, that's proven, that's yours to use, enable, and take advantage of. And you know, that will be inclusive of our web clients as well as the iOS and other variants. Conferencing servers. That's the point where we're going to pop back up a level and take a look under the hood, right? So we're going to take a look at, here's a server. What does it do? Here's some scenarios. We'll take a short look at the signaling for each scenario, then something about media, and we'll try to get a little bit deeper about, okay, what are some of the fundamental interdependencies there? What are the impacts to the users, impacts to you as an administrator? So that's when we're going to start getting a little bit deeper. I'm trying to build it in a way that makes sense for you, no matter who you are in the audience. We'll get into scheduling, and there I'm going to do some scheduling demo, and really all that's going to be about is the user experience. And in one sense, there are a lot of people I have found, a lot of customers, who get into Link, they are using Link, and if you're a partner, you've probably experienced them where once they see the Link meeting add-in for Outlook, they think they've understood all they need to know about how to leverage conferencing, how to schedule meetings, and what flexibility is there. Sometimes that's all the IT organization knows, and there's so much more that's available. So our objective in that section is going to be able to show you some of the things you can do. You can determine, is this a private meeting? You can determine the dial-in experience, whether or not people can be given delegated permissions, and this is as a user. So we want to make sure that we're clear as administrators and those who are trying to make some of the decisions about Link as a conferencing solution, what's there? And what is that experience like? And to be honest, it's in the user education that most often we find our solutions can be tough to get adopted. And it has little to do with the fact that the clients aren't cool, that the solutions don't work. It has to do with people don't have the right level of education about what's there and how to make it work. We will talk about dial-in because that is just, the PSTN is still here. Unless I'm mistaken, we're going to be using phones outside the perimeter for quite some time. So we want to make sure we talk a little bit about what are those call flows like and what it becomes a dependency on you for setting up your call numbers, where are you going to locate things like announcement services and the like. In that also, I will talk a little bit about HA and DR. Now, anybody attend the high availability DR sessions yet? I strongly recommend that you do. I think there's still one tomorrow. But you definitely want to take a look at survivability because if we're all clear, we're providing a solution for people to do business work on with conferencing. And if we don't have an HADR story for it that is solid, you do not understand the underpinnings of how that works, you're not presenting a very resilient solution. So we will talk about that briefly. I mean, it's like a 90-minute session that I'm going to condense into 9 minutes and two slides. So I'll certainly take some questions on it. And if there's anything else that I have to dive into, we can talk about that afterwards. And then capacity planning. And that's a bit of an iterative process, but honestly, I could have spent probably the whole session talking about planning, what tools are available, how important it is to plan different modalities, different components. But the reality is that would not be a very exciting or fun session. And it's a little bit, planning and looking at spreadsheets and that sort of thing is a bit like scratching your eye with a stick. So I'm going to spare you a long duration in the planning phase, but since it is important, we'll end there and talk about why that's one of the most important places to begin. So that being said, we're going to step into the demo. And so I've got my trusty VM. Well, I say trusty. We'll see how trusty it turns out to be. I'm not running by any stretch the fastest machine. In fact, I'm pretty sure that I have a machine that I do because a Commodore 64 just wasn't available. But I'm going to launch the deployment wizard. Can you guys see all that? Yeah, good. All right, so that's going to come up, and we're not going to spend a lot of time here. But those of you who've had any experience with Link 2010, those of you who've already deployed Link 2013, those of you who've maybe seen OCS know the deployment wizard. It's a tool that we've had for quite some time. It does, I don't know if you've noticed, but every version, it does a little bit less, doesn't it? So these days, for Link 2013, what the deployment wizard does is really just take a look at the Active Directory services, the infrastructure that you have, and one, does a quick assessment, is this ready? Is it Link ready? Two, it lets you make it Link ready, it's a good thing. And then three, it provides you the ability for kicking off installations, whether that be on a server, of a server, tools for management, that sort of thing. Now, This is definitely the area and space where we start to engage as a designer of a conferencing solution, the Active Directory Services team, right? As soon as you talk to somebody about, hey, I would like to extend the schema. I need to, like Exchange, Link is a forest level application, so we need to make add more attributes in the LDAP link. We need to start making changes to the domain. Typically, the Active Directory folks and security folks say, nope, my island, right? So you have now the ability to provide them with a tool so they can manage their Active Directory, okay? So all that's done now is when you fire up the deployment wizard, it takes a look at Active Directory, and it gives us a status here. And so far, it's given me a partial status, not a big deal here. We step ahead, it's gonna take some more time to think, and you know, in a better machine, this is a lot faster. But what's gonna happen is it's gonna take a quick look at the steps I've already gone through. I went through schema extensions, I went through forest prep. Anybody who's deployed Exchange is familiar with that. Anybody who's done OCS or Link has seen the same thing. And I have these happy check marks here, right? Green check marks. Green is good. And what's basically happening is Link deployment is looking at me saying, you know, love what you've done with the place. You look pretty good. A couple of things still remain. And at the bottom, it's going to tell me that I still need to make sure that I've prepared the current domain. No green check mark there. So, and this is the only step we're doing here, just to give you guys an idea of how straightforward it can be for either you or your, you know, your AD folks. The deployment wizard is just that. It is a setup tool that's going to give you simple options. Do you go back? Do you click next? Is this what you want to run? Here's what you should run. It's very, very simple. And in this case, very fast. But I'm going to leave this up here on the window, and let's see if I can. Nope, that's not going to work. As we're preparing domain, we're obviously using a GUI, right? We're using an application interface here. But you'll notice that the first line is enable CS, which sounds a whole lot like PowerShell. And so if you're in an organization where somebody wants to take care of all their AD preparatory tasks, extending schemas, ACLing new groups, creating those groups, that's all part of domain prep and all of those activities, that can be handled from within PowerShell. So the tool is here. And like most of what's in Link 2013, a lot of the activity that is done in PowerShell can be done in the GUI, but what we're seeing here in the GUI absolutely can be done in PowerShell, and that's always the case. So now we've already prepared the domain. And so just to give you an idea for those of you who weren't eavesdropping on me earlier as I was going through the first two steps, it was that fast. Now, obviously, there's a lot of planning that goes into deploying Link, but when you're preparing Active Directory, which once upon a time was a very onerous task, it's now become a very simple thing. We have the tool that tells you, is it ready? We have the tool that walks you through the steps, and getting to the steps is pretty simple. Now I'm gonna switch off this thing, and we're gonna launch Topology Builder. And Topology Builder, we're gonna spend a little bit of time on and then start getting into the bowels of the material here. But the reason we're gonna look at Topology Builder is because it is how you manipulate and establish a Link solution, be it conferencing or any other. In Link 2013, part of what we've done is we've schema. We actually did this earlier in 2010. We schematized the infrastructure database requirements of Link, and we put it into something called the CMS database. So we have this XML file that we're able to ship around to all these different servers, so that way every server can know something about the topology. And this is going to help you when it comes time to deploy, because in previous versions, you would have to take that deployment exe tool we were just using and hop from server A to server B, run the tool, run the bits, and that's a way to get things done as well. But now you can use Bootstrapper or you can use Enable CS Computer, these two scripts, to actually leverage an existing topology and let servers go get their own installation specs themselves. So you guys are the smart guys, right? You're the brilliant men and women here. You're going to figure out these servers will be designated for these tasks, but you're going to build out a topology in Link via Topology Builder, and you're going to tell the computers to go figure out what their role is, what services are they going to run, and they will be able to pull those things into action from CMS. So pretty proud of that. We did get that schematized in a very organized way, which enables that sort of extensibility and efficiency for deployment. Now, here at Topology Builder, you'd always have an option. When you kick this off, you can determine that it's time to download an existing topology that you want to work on, or you know, you've maybe been having an existing file that's that you want to open, so you haven't deployed it, but it is a file that you've been working on for a while, or you're going to create a new topology. And in this case, we'll go ahead and do a new topology. And I did a quick, the name is here because I just wanted to make sure that all my tools were working. So I'm going to go ahead and say, yes, replace it. So I'm effectively starting with a new topology, blank, clean slate. We're going to define this, and the first thing that link topology builder wants to know is SIP domain. So we're going to call this link conference, okay? Linkconf.com. That's our SIP domain. Next, topology builder says, well, is your organization going to have multiple SIP domains? This is a very easy one. We'll say, yeah. We'll pretend that we're going to have another SIP domain, Europe link conference, add that, and we're going to be able to progress. A word about multiple SIP domains. When you're talking about conferencing, multiple SIP domains starts to get a little bit tricky. It's not that the platform and the solution cannot handle it. It has to do with the management of things, right? When you define multiple SIP domains, and we'll take a look at this in more detail later, but you do end up in the world of having to establish more DNS entries. You do end up having to have more SAN entries in your certificates. So, you know, everything in Link is secured, right? We've got this TSL cloud where every host has to be able to verify who it is. And so the more SIP entries you have, now we have more traffic that now needs to just be able to align itself to that secure mechanism. And so what ultimately happens is, as an administrator, things get a little bit tricky. You're going to end up with multiple layers of meeting URLs for every type of SIP domain that you have, depending on the deployment. So this is just one of the areas you want to be careful. As a consultant, one of the things that I've seen is it's usually best if we can get those down at a customer down to a handful. And if you ever have a customer, say you're a partner or you're trying to figure this out for yourself, one of the great reasons or considerations is branding, right? So you don't want to have a lot of brands out there. If you're a company, you want to make sure that as you federate with other customers or with other organizations, they know that this is who you are as opposed to these 50 different flavors of you. That gets a little bit tricky for the other end in that scenario as well. So we're going to define the first site. We're just looking for a simple name, so we'll just call it Vegas because that just seems appropriate. We're in Vegas. Move forward here. It's looking for some site details. Now, obviously, in Link, sites are a little bit different than they are in Active Directory, right? So a site is just effectively a well-connected collection of servers and services. So a little bit different than Active Directory sites, just to be clear. And we're going to go ahead and open up the next part of the wizard here, which is going to step us through defining the front-end pool. And right now, I'm going to go the easy route, standard edition, because if I did more than that anyway, this computer would just fall over. And so I need to have some sort of FQDN here. So I'm going to say SCO1.linkconf.com, which was hopefully what I put in earlier. And now it's saying, great, I know now as Topology Builder that there's going to be a server that's got that FQDN. It's going to have that name, and it's going to have some roles. So, what are those roles? What are those services? What is it going to do? Right at the top here, we have conferencing. Well, given that this is a conferencing session, we should probably click check, right? Dial in PSTN. Do we want that? Well, obviously, I'm going to say yes to that, but the reason should be pretty clear. How do you have folks dial? How do you have a conferencing solution where even your own users have to be at their desks, right? What if they're at home and they want to be able to dial into literally and join a work conference? We're not talking about a third party now or another organization. We're just talking about people who are just trying to stay connected and live the conferencing dream with you. Enterprise voice. Do we want that? Absolutely. Why? Because what about the folks who just need to be dialed out? We have that call it work scenario, right? Where you're just on the road, you click say from a mobile device and you say, I'm at a Starbucks, go ahead and join, but call me. Because you're not in an area where you can do a straight VoIP connection to the conference, right? Our devices can do VoIP and video now, but maybe that's not the scenario you're in. You just want to have a phone call. So this is going to be enabled only if enterprise voice is enabled for the organization. You have to have Link enabled to be able to make a call out to the PSTN to reach somebody. Call admission control, also called CAC, which is just, you've probably heard CAC. There's a few CAC sessions, I think, here. It sounds like we're clearing our throat, but really that's just a methodology for managing bandwidth, making sure that if you have links that you've identified on the network that are sensitive, that are overloaded, we are respectful, we being the solution, are respectful of those limitations there. So we try to work in a very intelligent way where we have bandwidth constraints. We find other ways to route traffic. Depending if this was just a pure voice session, I might talk to you about how we can actually route out over edge, out to the PSTN and come back into the organization another way. But for conferencing, it still matters because we have things like voice and video still, which can be intensive on the network. And if that's not If you don't know what your network can handle, the first step is certainly going to be to figure that out. So we'll say yes for call admission control, though we won't configure that today. We'll talk a bit more about when that comes into play later. Archiving. This actually enables some Exchange Server integration. You know, previous versions, archiving was just living on its own in some database, in some server. Now we can actually save a level of material within Exchange that makes it possible for somebody to find those archived messages. And of course, monitoring, that's a must. In any media deployment, which I know no one who deploys Link just for IM anymore, you need monitoring. Monitoring to let you know what's happening now, to be able to troubleshoot the help desk of here's what went wrong in a call or what we think was it someone's headset. We don't really know. Monitoring is just, it gives us telemetry, right? It's giving us all the data we need to know to the segment, to the call, how a call was set up, what the quality of that call was like, and that certainly applies in conferencing as well. Co-locate mediation server, I'll just mention this briefly. Mediation server is our conduit for transcoding audio into different codecs, right? G711, are we doing RT audio? Do we have to go back and forth between the two? We can also trunk directly to that from the PSTN. In this scenario, I'm going to co-locate the mediation server, and often in smaller deployments, that's fine. When you do have a high need for transcoding, though, you're not going to do a lot of media bypass, and you are going to have a large scale. You probably want to have this be standalone. And here, it wants to know, are we going to associate this pool? And a pool, of course, is a collection of Link servers that are the fundamental building blocks, the big Legos, if you will, for a Link topology. It wants to know, are we going to connect this to an edge server or an edge pool? And in this case, I don't have edge, but edge is what's going to enable all this wonderful Link goodness to be accessible to your users and to some third parties, if you choose to federate, outside the walls of your organization, the logical walls, if you will. In this case, though, we're not actually going to go forward with that. Now, in this case, it's talking about a SQL store. Standard Edition has its own SQL built into it, right? It's a single box. In a larger enterprise pool, you have Link front ends, and you have a distinct SQL back end. Defining file store and web services URL. So there's a lot that happens now with web. We use web heads for a variety of things. How people are connecting, how services are connecting. Hey, I want to see a PowerPoint in a meeting. That sounds like PowerPoint. It's actually a web head that you're going to start streaming to and from using a PowerPoint viewer that we've embedded in the client and in the Office web app server. So URLs are critically important. You can't tank any of them, and you have to plan them well. Otherwise, you end up going back to change your URLs, and that's a bad place to be, because inevitably you'll end up orphaning some service, or in the interim maybe some meetings will expire and users won't be able to get to the things that they need to. So speaking of Office Web App Server, this is the creature formerly known as WAC. And Office Web App Server is actually a shared resource. It's not really a Link-centric thing. It's something that the Office group has established that allows us to share and render in a very consumable fashion some of their documents. So for Link 2013 today, it's PowerPoint only, just to be clear. But the Office group has already established a great roadmap for how they're going to start using these things, not just with the SharePoint world and Exchange, but how we're going to start to be able to consume other document formats in a very rich, rich manner. And archiving. This is really just a compliance notion, so if it's something that we have to have, we will. Your organization requires it, certainly we can do it. Point of interest, the archiving and monitoring services actually live now on every front end. So it's a much more resilient story, and we'll get into a little bit of how that works once we get to the slides, but just to keep in mind, what we do now in a Link server is a little bit more robust than what we've ever done before. And so there's some change, some delta. If you know Link 2010, well, we're doing a little more in 2013 that's very, very specific to enhancing the resiliency of services and making sure that each server is able to handle a lot of this work itself. So monitoring, same story. Okay, so at this point, Topology Builder says, yay, you're done. And we're going to look this over and make sure things are where they need to be here. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but let's expand out this site here and take a look at what we don't have. So here's Link 2010, and typically we'd have some AV conferencing pools, right? That sounds like a Link 2010 deployment. We'd probably have some monitoring servers, some archiving servers. Here in 2013, under that leaf, they're gone. And that's because we've consolidated those services into the Link front ends themselves. So if you have a standard edition server, it's able to actually provide its own monitoring and archiving services. So you still obviously can have a final destination, and as you saw, Topology Builder wants a SQL instance somewhere that's a designated final resting place, if you will, for, say, your archiving as an example. But the service is run on your front ends. It does help us to have a leaner deployment model and something that scales more. It seems to be a much more brick-type approach. You will notice, though, persistent chat. It is here, and Link 2010 is not, and that has really nothing to do with conferencing. I just want to point out that persistent chat is now a more full-fledged managed citizen in the Link world. And then down here in shared components, we see our SQL Server stores, file stores. We defined a share earlier, and that has to do with web content specifically for conferencing. But Office Web App Servers, which can be as a farm or can be standalone. So here we have our web app server. This is the FQDN that will determine how we get to it. And one thing that I probably blazed over too quickly, you will notice that it says Office Web App Server internal. In Topology Builder, there was a check mark. Do you want this to be an externally accessible resource? And the reason for that is since everything we generate in the back end for some of these services for your users is about webheads and URLs, Topology Builder will determine if there's going to be an edge and reverse proxy deployed, we're going to have to generate different types of URLs based on a user's experience, right? So if you have an organization that has edge, there's a chance a user will join from the outside. So when they join a meeting, they'll actually receive multiple URLs, and the client figures out, based on where they are, how to consume those resources. If you don't define little things like the check mark for, yes, make this available externally, you end up with a fully deployed edge solution and users who sometimes are not able to get what they need from a meeting conference. These are one of the areas that we just have to pay particular attention to. Okay, so that was the quick overview, if you will, of the of Topology Builder, the deployment. All that to say, hey, getting to the point where you define a conferencing solution in Link is very, very simple. Because that deployment wizard and that the Topology Builder wasn't just about conferencing. Clearly, that's where a lot of the workloads live. But the goal is to have a very simple and efficient approach for deploying Link Server. We think that we've got something like that built up really well with Topology Builder. It allows you to manipulate the environment, make changes offline. You can even run Topology Builder on a laptop, a desktop, upload the file, and then your servers are able to get the services that they need. Now, conferencing. Let's talk a little bit about the clients that are engaged here. So this cascading slide of different capabilities, some of this is very familiar. If you know Link 2013, it's all familiar. Instant messaging, application sharing, audio, video, these are core to the product, right? This is the stuff that we've been doing for a while. PowerPoint is something that's newer for us to be able to consume with the web access server. Whiteboards, conferencing-centric, polls, scheduling, recording, all conferencing-centric. So there's a lot of what we do here now that in the earlier phases of our communication server product was not so conferencing-centric. Now, clearly, that's the direction we're going, the collaboration element of things. You will notice I say new for notes. And I'm speaking of OneNote here, the OneNote integration for a meeting. I don't know if it, did anybody go to Nikolai's presentation yesterday on what's new in Link meetings? All right. When you get back home, it's interesting to see a quick review of what specific features are there in the client, what's new that's forthcoming. But one of the things that just tickles me all the time is just the OneNote integration. Because if you think about it, we've now given you the ability within the context of a meeting to basically say, I'm going to take notes. These people who are joining this conference, they can see notes. They can take notes. It's not a whiteboard. It's not messy. Why it took us so long to figure out the most common thing that's done in a meeting is note-taking, I do not know. But we got it figured out now so that there is rich integration with OneNote. And so it allows people to take their images, their diagrams, their notes, and have it placed in there. What's coming forward soon is some intelligence on the background. You join the meeting, you're checked off there in the OneNote. You've got photos, screenshots, things that are taking place live on the desktop can be brought into the meeting contextually, right? The context is that meeting note set. So it's a very good thing, good direction, and I think it's a rather overlooked feature. So on the left side, we've got our traditional link client, right? This is this thing that's your 32, 64-bit client that's living on your laptop or desktop. We do have the link web application. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. But a very robust offering, because today, if you were to go down to the demo area in the expo hall, you could actually see somebody pull up the link client, join a meeting from the full link client. They bring up the link web application, and the symmetry is amazing. Short of being able to see the browser, be it Firefox, it doesn't matter. But short of seeing the browser frame, the experience is the same. And that's incredible. We also have a VDI client and a Link Modern client, which is effectively the Windows 8 native client. We also have worked with our partners and continue to refine our Link Phone Edition client. And you guys are familiar, of course, with the Outlook add-in, or you should be. That's just the plugin where we're able to click and start off a new meeting or a schedule a meeting specific to you, and it's going to generate the meeting conferencing join URLs. In the middle is Link Web Scheduler and Outlook Web Access. Now, this is kind of new for us because our web scheduling has been a bit of a pain point for us, especially in migrations from other platforms. Now it ships with the product. But if you're someone who has Exchange or an O365 user and you have Outlook Web Access, you now should have seen, and if you haven't, you have the ability to schedule from within the Web Access experience. So typically in the past, if you weren't sitting at your desktop and you didn't have Outlook and you didn't have the add-in, you were hosed. Now you can use the web interface and you can actually have a function that's similar to the Outlook Web Outlook add-in. You click New Link Meeting, and away you go. It's an online meeting. Link Recording Manager, client-side function, just, again, giving you the opportunity to manage, to not only record it, but to manage your meetings. And then finally, on the right side, Link Meeting Room Systems. Obviously, it's new. There's a lot that can be said about it, so I will let you go to the demo booth to see those live or to go to any of those sessions. But I will say that it is, very simply put, a Link client in the very immersive, expansive room experience. You've seen our mobile clients, and you know that we have some new stuff on the way as far as those for Android, but when I refer to Link Mobile, I'm including Windows Mobile, iOS, the whole kit and caboodle. And then PBX phones and PSTN phones. So why are they here? Because we don't make those, right? Those aren't our clients. Well, they're not. But from a conferencing perspective, the reason we need dial-in, the reason you need to think about global voice policies, and the reason you need to think about call emission control, as you're going to see, is because those are the people you still serve. They're still going to call in from the PSTN, or you're still going to have somebody inside the house who's saying, I just need to be called back at my desk. And it's a PBX phone, and it's not a Link device. So we have to consider those as well. I'm not going to spend a ton of time. Sure. Absolutely. So all our 2013, so the request that a gentleman was making was just that I speak to where we have to talk specifically about versions. And so I'm probably not going to get into each mobile platform's device, although I can't provide that for you afterwards. I will say the 2013 release wave of the clients is where you're going to see all those things supported. The obvious difference is when we're talking about something like a PBX phone or a PSTN, that's just general, right? That's not anything that we're managing. What we do have to do is build the infrastructure to support it. So this is just a high-level overview of Link Web App. I'm trying to use a consistent approach here, blue, red, and green on certain slides to help the information be more consumable. I think it could just be I lack imagination. But for now, what this is trying to communicate is what it is, HTML5 and JavaScript. That's our Link Web App. It gives you a plugin for AV. It supports authenticated and anonymous users. So again, if you haven't seen this, I encourage you to get to the demo booth, take a look, because the symmetry between the web app and the full client is just spectacular. You do have some of those presenter abilities. It is a pretty immersive experience. All the way on the right, the default for non-Link 2013 joins. That's kind of a weird run-on sentence, right? Here's what this means. When you do not have a Link client and you join a Link meeting, the default is we're going to try to provide the user who's joining LWA experience. So they're going to be prompted and have the opportunity to install the plugin and join the meeting and be able to consume the media like everyone else. Now, what if you have the Link client, and this comes up a lot, or came up at least in Nikolai's session yesterday. You have the Link client, but you want to use the web browser. So there's this little handy trick, and I think whether or not it's handy might be a little bit subjective, but if you put question mark SL equals at the end of a join URL, so we're talking, you've clicked the Outlook, create a meeting, it says it creates all the stuff here, here's the dial-in number, click to join, right? If you were to actually add that silver, that's really a silver light trick here, that switch at the end of the join URL, whoever clicked that, even if they had a Link client, would have the Link web app open. By default, though, if you have both on your laptop, you will only, we default to the logic of the Link full client. So we will not just prompt and give you an option, do you want to do this in web or Link? If you have Link, you're going to have the Link client experience unless you do that. But that will affect everyone who receives the URL. And then there's this notion of show join using legacy client Link enable. What that is a PowerShell commandlet that gives you the opportunity, if you're an organization that says has R2 clients, some legacy clients, you've got some folks living maybe with Link attendee clients, and you're transitioning to 2013, and you want those people to still use their clients. You still want them to join with an R2 client. You want them to join with Link attendee. You can use this PowerShell to enable that capability. Now, conferencing services. This is the part where I take a drink of water. Pause for effect. Now we're going to get into the details. How does this stuff work? IM, it's a conferencing service. So let me ask you a question. When somebody makes a Link video call, is that through conferencing servers or is that point to point? If it's Joe to Bob? Peer to peer. Okay, so that was video that I said, right? They do an audio call. What happens? Peer to peer. They send an IM. What happens? Conferencing. Everything in Link, every call setup is via the SIP protocol, right? Session initiation protocol. But as it turns out, we use SIP as the transport for IM. All IMs go through a conferencing server. All IMs go through the Link server. This is part of how we're able to ensure certain levels of hygiene. We're able to do things like the IM filter, URL filter, some file, hey, what files can we allow? What files do we want to block? It's one of the ways we're able to do archiving. So it's funny, few people actually think of it that way, but in fact, IM, our IM conferencing server, is that. And IMs are always a conferencing scenario. SIP has some strong rules about chain of custody. You have to follow a certain path for messages from one person to another. They have to follow the same path, so it's never a peer-to-peer thing. You will always go through what's called a SIP proxy, in this case, Link server. So it is it does allow the experience of peer-to-peer, but make no mistake, even two people is a conference, but yes, you can have many people in an IM session. That's probably what most refer to as an IM conference, if they even use the phrase at all. We do have some stuff that comes with the product, such as intelligent IM filters, right? So we're able to take a look at URLs, we're able to take a look at files, and you can block some or all. That's in there. If you use the control panel, which is the web-based interface for administering Link, there's an IM and presence tab, that's where you'll find these. But you can also use PowerShell, and I've got those listed there, CS file transfer filter and CSIM filter, right? Yeah. So those are how you're able to handle some of those mechanisms, and it's actually because the IM traffic always goes through the Link server.
Is there any way to block filters just from the external perspective?
So there is filtering that can happen at the edge, absolutely. So there's work that you can do at the edge. So the question was, hey, can you manage things at the edge? Now, I want to make sure I'm clear. Are you talking about coming from a third party or just internal to internal? But so it's an employee to another employee, but that second employee is at Panera instead of the office.
More I was talking about if you were federated, right?
Okay.
If you want to block from any other.
Gotcha. So that's more of an edge discussion. You do have the ability to provide some filtering there at Edge. There are also a lot of third parties and partners that play in this space, and one in particular is the matter of ethical walls. That's where we have one organization, but different cultures and groups within. So the people in this, everyone in this room is in the same company. The people over here can talk to these folks, but they can't talk with the folks on this side of the room. How do we block that? Well, in the Link 2013 product, we don't have a way to do that. But we have some partners who come up with some really slick and innovative ways to manage that. So that element is there. And we have folks who do a lot of work. In fact, there was somebody who presented yesterday, Ruby Maximo, does a lot at the edge level for security. AS conferencing, application sharing. So it's sadly a little bit difficult to tell, but at the very top, that arrow is bidirectional. That's the person that's both receiving and sending. The other two folks are simply receiving, consuming the media from an application share. Now, the share protocol, what do we use for application sharing?
RDP,
remote desktop protocol. So it's the same thing that we use for remote server administration, which enables us to do some pretty cool things from within Link. By encapsulating this in RTP, we're able to say, hey, I can share my desktop, I can share an application, I can allow you to control my application. So some of this stuff is actually quite sophisticated. Oh, I think we've done a good job leveraging RDP in that way. We do provide some policies so you can control this. We allow you to determine, hey, will this desktop sharing at all be allowed? Enabled or not? You know, do you allow participants to have control? Yes or no? What about external people? You can determine, do external people have the ability to take control? And if you think about that, it makes sense from a business standpoint. You know, you're doing a presentation to a customer, you're showing a spreadsheet. If you give the customer control, this third party, now they have the ability to go through the rest of the material that maybe that's not what you want them to see, right? So for plenty of security and business reasons, we actually enable some policies that govern the RDP experience. We've also done a little bit more in the way of bandwidth and quality. So for those of you who are familiar with the Link 2010 experience, you know RDP is bursty by nature. We're taking pictures of screens, screen scrapes, sending the stuff along the wire, and obviously at first, that's a big impact to the network. Afterwards, though, it tends to be smaller deltas. And then you've got the folks who everybody wants to use it at first, and then a large population falls back really on things like PowerPoint. But what we've done is allowed for some app sharing bitrate monitoring and some limiting as well. So that way you're able to have a view into this. You know, we've got some media quality reporting now in QoE that's specific to application sharing. So this was a gap that we had in 2010. We enabled the feature. We didn't give you a lot of insight or tools to be able to manage what is this doing to my network? Or the network guy says this is happening. Is it? You didn't have that ability. Now in 2013, we're able to give you that level of QoE on application sharing specifically. So we have those tags as we need them there. Now, AP conferencing server, my favorite. Why? It's the only MCU that does two things, right? So it's doing audio and it's doing video. And every so often, even yesterday at the demo, somebody will say, hey, I want to have audio over here and video on this device, and I want that to be broken up. And they're like, why can't I do that? And you know, simple things like lip syncing, being able to watch the video and have it be in sync with the person's with the audio. Those are things that our AV conferencing server handle. It does quite a bit. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time here working on that. For one, I keep advancing the computer that's not doing the presentation, which is just very ineffective. AV conferencing server. So we've got all these speakers, and they're all independently sending a stream up to the AV MCU. Simple scenario, right? But here's what happens on the receiving end. In AV conferencing server, we do two things. We do switching, and we do mixing. For audio, we do mixing. We will send you, if you're one of the participants, a single audio stream of the top five talkers that we've identified. So there's some intelligence running there. Link is trying to figure out who the active speakers are, who the common speakers are, takes that audio, mixes it up together into a single stream, sends it to you. That way you don't consume five separate streams every time somebody talks. And we, at the ABMCU, we start to do any of the mixing alterations that we need to if the popular speaker starts to change, right? So he was talking a lot, then he stops talking, and she's talking a lot. Well, we're going to make sure that you get that in the stream. That's a very network sensible way to handle audio. So there are a lot of people sending individual streams, and we make it so that you're able to consume a single one that has the multiple participants. That's mixing. We do something very different, though, in the video. In video, we actually do something more related to switching. Now, I've got this icon here that says HD, and that's because, yeah, in Link 2013, we're doing full HD, so we're talking about 1080p, 30 frames per second. Can be bandwidth intensive, but in most scenarios, people aren't going to do that. They don't have the hardware to necessarily encode and decode HD video. And they're not certainly not able to send it at that rate anyway. But let's just pretend right now we have a video conference going. And we have a lot of people doing video. These streams are making their way up from each individual participant up to the AV conferencing server. The AV conferencing server, though, isn't mixing video. What it's going to do is provide you up to 5 streams based on your subscription. Here's what I mean by subscription. You have 2 options. One, here are the people that are the top talkers that are going to show up. Your link client says, those are the folks I want to see. Your other option is to say, I want to specifically see these 2 individuals all the time. Because one is my boss, and the other is this girl who always forgets her videos on and she starts picking her nose or something. I mean, you get to pick and tell, control the client what streams you're actually getting access to. Now keep this in mind. There is actually a very business sensible case for that. If you are in the environment where you're making a sales pitch and a stakeholder's in a room that's perhaps not saying a whole lot, you want to see this person's reaction, whether they're speaking or not. You have the ability to control that. It's in the subscription. There's something else that we do with these subscriptions. Your client will send in the RTCP packeting, which RTCP is our control protocol. It'll say, here's my client. Here's what I can do. Here's what I can't do. I can't eat HD. I can't consume that resolution. I can't do 30 frames per second. So what the AVMCU is able to do is take this on a case-by-case basis and say, this user can consume HD. This is a room system over here that's able to take full HD and stereo audio, send it along. But this person cannot. So we're going to be able to ratchet that resolution down, lower the frame rate, and be able to give the user on downstream, who maybe doesn't have the best network, an appropriate experience without impacting them. So that's one of the, there I go again, advancing the wrong slide. Or computer. So audio is mixed, video is switched. We're doing this with H.264. This is new for the product, and that we're also using the SVC set of 264 standard. And the reason for that is that it provides temporal scalability, right? And which is, you know, everybody knows about temporal scalability. You go to bed thinking about temporal scalability, I know. But all that is the ability to ratchet down the frame rate downstream as needed. And we have that in the SVC standard. RTV is still in the product. This is really for R2 and 2010 participants. H.263, when we're talking about video, is not. That was the very low G711 version of video, SIF quality. It didn't make any sense for us to keep it anymore. So it's just not in the product. We also stole something kind of cool from our R&D, smart cropping, which, you know, has nothing at all to do with conferencing server, but I think is very cool. Basically, this is facial recognition, right? So you're sitting there in a conference, and you may have noticed if you're using Link 2013 that even though you started off with this big view, widescreen thing happening, all of a sudden it's here. It's your face, right? Up close and personal. There's a purpose behind that. Obviously, we're trying to help you conserve real estate on the screen. And so it does enable us to do that. You can now have more people. And the link client, this is a client-side feature, is able to determine, what am I sending? What am I cropping out here? What don't I need? We are using facial recognition software to do that. Now, that's not a license to say, hey, I can join a conference in my, you know, in a dress shirt and in my boxers or something. We'd prefer that you be professional all the time, especially because if you spontaneously grow a second head, or perhaps more likely, somebody joins you in the room, the client will recognize this, will see the second face, and expand the view, at which point you're seen in your boxers, right? So I think the notion here is that we're giving you intelligence to help manage the desktop experience. Because what's most important usually isn't the video of just the face, it's there's PowerPoints, there's other media that's being transmitted here, and people need to be able to work, collaborate, either in notes, in their whiteboard. And so seeing all the unnecessary space doesn't help at all. Find the right computer. Now, a couple of things. When we're managing video, we do encourage people to let the AVMCU do the smart thinking for you. You define a topology builder, all the things we need to know about where servers and sites are. You use things like CAC, it's down at the bottom, but I'll mention it anyway, to let Link server know, here's where my network is sensitive, here's where it can handle some extra load, here's where it cannot. All right, and you, AVMCU will handle some of this for you. We also provide you some policies, and particularly those last two, video bit rate for the send and then the receive, where you're able to cap out and say, here, by policy, I just don't need to send this type of a video stream. I don't need to send this much on the wire. We're going to give you the ability to do that. It's in there. Do we need to see multi-view for every attendee? You can control that via policy as well. The one thing I would say is we noticed that when we go to customers who light this stuff up for the first time, there's the novelty effect. Everyone just loves it. Everybody needs it full screen. Everybody needs to be seen. They need to see you. It's cool. And after a while, people are not doing that. They've started to say, well, I need to share this Excel document on screen sharing, or I need to work on the PowerPoint. And the novelty, the need to just have the real estate and therefore the bandwidth for video is pretty light. And truthfully, there's a lot of horsepower that goes into a machine being able to send HD video, especially at 30 frames per second. So what often happens is we see two or three streams on average with users. We're talking about 500 kilobits per second. Not the HD monstrosity. So we'll have some tools at the end that'll help you plan for that. But I just wanted to make sure you guys understood. Adoption sometimes is scary. We recommend a lot of measuring before you start cutting. So the measure before you cut things should probably say measure twice, right? You've enabled the service, see what's happening, but don't cut immediately because usage and usage behavior changes dramatically with video. So that's a whole lot about AV Conferencing MCU all at once. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the web app server. And I'm going to let this build this slide out here. Let's see. Okay. I'm so far behind, it's ridiculous. Web app server, so we already talked a little bit about what this does. For Link 2013, it's doing PowerPoints, all right? So this is giving you the ability to consume via a web stream office documents, and today that's explicitly PowerPoint. It's a shared resource, it's not just Link specific. You can point a pool to it, as you saw in Topology Builder, but it can also be a farm, a set of servers that you use for SharePoint and Exchange. It can be shared between pools, and it's one of those roles that actually can be virtualized for a small deployment. We do allow external access as well for that, and so that's why we have to be able to generate additional sets of URLs, because the path in to see it from the outside through Edge and reverse proxy is completely different than folks sitting inside your organization. So this slide, I'm going to try to build this quickly here. This is just a scenario where we've got a blue box, which is the Link world, right, the Link cloud. You have a data MCU. You've got knowledge about Outlook Web Access Services. This is formerly called WAC, if I didn't say that already. And so, you know, Microsoft, we juggle around a lot of names and then finally decide which one we want. This one is, this representation here is to let you know that things like the URLs for presenters, for viewers, internal, external, all this stuff is kept in CMS, right? That's that database that is shared. All the Link servers have a copy of this and they're able to know, okay, so where will I go when a conference starts? How do I get to Outlook Web Access Server? That stuff is there. And then you have the content share. And what I want to show here is roughly what happens when you have people start to share stuff. I've just built this out the whole way here to keep it keep the momentum here. But if you've got a presenter, the first thing they do is they upload the file. They do this still in the legacy manner. It goes up to the data MCU, but then it gets brought to the share. All right. At the point where they start to present, and we have an attendee, URLs start getting shipped around. And this looks a little bit messy, but all we're really doing is shipping URLs around, right? So you have an attendee who comes in, who gets a broadcast URL and an authorization token. And they're able to take that URL and say, okay, let me look that URL up in DNS. Great, it's this server, it's Outlook Web Access. They send their request over there. Outlook Web Access proxies that. It takes that token, it takes the URL request, and it goes to the data MCU, which then takes it over to the share to actually get the file. Why? Because the file that you're presenting never lives on the Outlook Web Access server. So it retrieves that file, presents the file finally to the attendee. In the case that you have somebody who's operating, say, Link 2010, they end up with a very different experience. They're still using the legacy experience. They're not using Outlook Web Access, so they're actually eating from the data MCU directly. They're getting basically pictures of the PowerPoint is the older way of doing things. So presenters ultimately end up uploading two versions. And if you have a Link 2013 client, you're able to go and see that private view. Anybody know what that is? Where you're able to just click ahead, you know, I'm presenting something to you, but you're impatient, so you're like, well, I just want to see the next couple of slides. You can do that. The 2010 client cannot. That is a 2013 Outlook Web Access Server feature that they have available to them. So the 2010 folks get the 2010 experience. 2013 gets the new stuff. Important just to know that this is a per pool config, and you got to know where the file is, and I'll tell you why in just a second. But some considerations general to conferencing server. We do have some commandlets that will help you set policy. Things like port ranges. This is how you're able to make things well and lovely with the network folks who are trying to make sure they can manage. How do they apply QoS markings to traffic? Well, maybe you can say, I'm going to tell the AV MCU, these are the types of ports you can use. This is what you can use to send on, and you allow the network folks to say, fine, any of the traffic that comes in from there, we'll know what to do with it. We'll mark it and send it the right way. But content comes up a lot. How long does content live for? How can I change that duration? There it is, content grace period. The default's 15 days for stuff that's brought up to the share. Remember, it never lives on the web access server, and you're able to adjust that. Storage size, max upload, again, those are there. You can reference this slide later for if you need to. Topology Builder is where you're going to make the changes for Outlook Web Access, and we do provide a resource kit for looking at things like conferencing data, especially if you say have web content, conferencing content that's been put on the share, and as an administrator, you need to go. Somebody's been terminated, left the company. How do you get that data? How do you manipulate it? How do you do anything with it? We provide a tool for you to do that there. I will also say this: there was a version of this presentation that made it to the wild, to the public in TechEd, and there was a reference to the notion that you can adjust the size of a file that Outlook Web Access can serve up. I think it was referenced as whack.xml. And so I got this presentation a couple weeks ago, started looking through some of the fact-checking here, got onto my server, and what do you know, couldn't find the file. And about 45 minutes later, I got a phone call that said, yeah, you know that file? I don't think it's there. So what does that mean? Managing the bandwidth for WAC or for the web access server is very, very different than what you may have heard before. Honestly, the limitation is not one in a configuration file. PowerPoint by default has a 4 gigabyte limit. PowerPoint Viewer inherits this limit with one consideration, time. It has to take, consume, convert a file in 30 seconds. So if you've had Link 2013 and you've started to work with WAC or the Office Web App Server and you've had files, say a PowerPoint that has a video embedded in it, and for some reason it didn't seem to render or present, it could be an issue of the time it took the Outlook Web App, the Office Web App Server to go get that file and to convert it. So that's where the size of the file can have an impact on the usage of that service. So if for some reason that's a very disturbing update to receive, I totally understand. I will take responsibility, and if you come talk to me afterwards, I will humbly and promptly give you the phone number of the guy who said the wrong thing earlier. Archiving. Already talked about the fact that we have a new way of managing the service. It's on the Link servers. We actually have two types of services that sound like lists, but this one, Link Storage Service, it's very specific to archiving. It archives content locally. Every Link server now has a database. It is writing data there, and when the time is right, it's committing it to the separate SQL store. So archiving moves to the front end. Whiteboarding and polling are through the data MCU. What do I mean by that? I mean that you have the ability now from the IM MCU, from the data MCU, and your archive store to have a cohesive story now where you're actually able to say, hey, I need to take this whiteboard from a meeting and archive this as well. That's part of the notes, right? It's not just the IM. How do we archive the whiteboard? We turn it to an XML file. We actually also ship a viewer so you can reconstruct it and see that file outside of Link if that's ever necessary. Conferencing, high availability, and DR. So I have a ridiculously short amount of time, and I am going to try to get through all this. In a very, this is the HADR session in 30 seconds, right? So obviously we have our link pool on the left, and I'm a little bit selfish in this session. I'm talking about conferences, conference directory. What are the conferences? What are their names? What are their numbers? Where do they live in RTC? And meeting content. All that other modality stuff, it's great. There's an HA story for it, but we're talking about conferencing. High availability is achieved when you have a link pool, three servers that are leveraging what we call a Windows fabric. And so if one server goes down, the rest take over, not a big deal. They are all writing to their respective databases, but there's a backup service here that sits in the middle. And that backup service takes a link server in one pool and effectively pairs it with a server in another pool. That way, data that's kept in that link pool that's the source gets replicated to a completely distant and remote link pool. That receiving server then commits it to its database, including, as you can see, meeting content. So what that means is, if you were to have to fail your users over from one pool to another, in the case of a disaster, and it was during a conference, there's actually a chance you would get there, and the whiteboard from the meeting that was going on at the time of the failure would still be current. That's a pretty spectacular thing. We demoed that at TechEd and last year's Link conference, but that's still the story. So what do you do with all that in a real-world scenario? So let's build one out here. We've got North America. It's got a pool. It's got a database. We've got a separate region. We're calling it EMEA. We have these shared services. CMS is there. Monitoring servers there. Again, it's more resilient now because the service already, monitoring service itself lives on the front end. We've got the formerly WAC service. Servers, content shares, Exchange servers. I put it there because I kind of feel bad for Exchange leaving it out. But you know, you do need it for voicemail if you're doing enterprise voice. But it is also there, obviously, as an archive source. And let's have some mediation servers, the PSTN, and now the Edge in the second pool. It's our backup service that lives between North America and EMEA. It's taking something from the pool up there. It's copying all that data over, getting it committed to a database so that effectively you have this mirror image of your environment. That being said, you can use other services like Standard Edition as opposed to having a like-for-like example. I have seven servers in this topology over here. I have to have the exact same configuration over there. There are ways to kind of get around that. Not sure that everybody in the product group would always think that you're best when you fail to something smaller that doesn't scale as well. There are some considerations and concerns with that, but from a pure service standpoint, yeah, data will get copied over there. So a lot of planning that should go into your HADR for conferencing. Now, before we get into schedule and join, I wanted to show a little bit about the client experience here. And 705. How am I for time? This clock thing never ended up working. I have 10 minutes, that's great. Actually, my phone says I have 9 minutes. So let's see, 9 minutes and just a whole lot of stuff. So here's what I'm going to do. Are you guys seeing my desktop? No, you're not. Stop lying, you're not. There we are. Okay, so there we are, there's my desktop. That's a task manager to manage all the memory I don't have in this machine. What I want to show very quickly is just an overview of some of the features that are there and that I want to tie it into the next couple of slides so that there's context to it. All right, so Meet Now. Here's a feature probably everybody should know and understand. That was pretty quick. It's saying, hey, you're going to join a meeting now. How do you want to join this meeting? Did I drag some people in? Maybe I will later. I just want to hurry up and have a conference space right this second. I click that drag down window and boom, I've spun up a conference. I can have use the link native audio. I can have it call me at a phone number, assuming I've defined one there. That's my cell phone. Now that I think about that, I've just published that to the world. That's pretty funny. And then, of course, I could say don't join audio, because there's always the chance that you're just here to you're going to be consuming this web conference, sitting next to somebody in a room where there's a speaker. You don't need that audio, right? So you can control this as a user. One of the bits that's worth at least pointing out is where these things are configured. For folks who don't know, you come over into options. You do have the ability within phones to determine what numbers are there, how they'll be published. Here at the bottom, I'm presenting, so I can't zoom into that. Join conference calls, join meeting audio from. If you have multiple devices, or multiple lines, you can set a default. And you can also flag to say, hey, and this is a policy as well, to say, before I join meetings, always prompt me. Let me decide what device is going to handle this. The same will happen for audio and for video. I do want to show you in video, though. Yeesh. Horrible angle. Right there, crop and center my video in meetings. There are people who just do not want to see their head. And based on this, I might be one of them. But the way this works is, I've got a boss who just always drags other people into the room, and so he just expects that you can see the whiteboard and you can see the people he's dragged in unwillingly to the conference. So that just gets unchecked for him, and the cropping, that recognition that we talked about, never takes place. Recordings, you get some flavors, what's the fidelity that we're looking for there in the recordings, and then link meetings. The reason I'm pointing this out to you here is note that you have an option to change the default for the client. You can have more than one client on a machine now, and so you can obviously have a join from different client, be it a legacy client or be it the web client. So here I have only two clients on. I have the Windows 8 client on, modern, and then I've got the more traditional 32-bit application. So that's what's there at the feature level. Now, what happens when we do this, when we click a new link meeting, right? So, hey, look at this, join link meeting. For those of you who knew Link 2010 and Outlook, we used to have the simple URL there. We don't have it anymore. You can see it now that I'm highlighting it. You can see the whole URL. Eventually, we realized it just wasn't simple. Nobody liked to see it. So what we did was we put some words in here, just join the link meeting. The simple URL is still there. It's still exposed. You see that we've got a join by phone option here. But what if you needed to find a different local number? You click this link and boom. Here's a table that MSIT populates so that way users like me at Microsoft are able to find a local number. What about you? Or what about first when you're scheduling a call? Let's say I'm scheduling a call with somebody in South America, say Colombia. Should they really be calling this Redmond-based number? Probably not. So if I come up here to meeting options, I can effectively just say, hey, you know what? I would like to look at a different location. I think most people will dial into this conference from, well, I've got options here. I think I've completely blown by, there we go. All right, so watch what happens here below join by phone. When I click OK, it's a separate number now. So there's a way for your users to even manage and be thoughtful about the folks that they're going to be conferencing in with. Where is that population going to come from? Where do you want those dial-in numbers to be set up? There's a lot happening here in a very right within the client. You also have this notion of dedicated meeting spaces, right? So I don't know if anyone's realized this if you're currently a Link user, but your Link conference by default is always on. Right, so you get a meeting URI, you have a conference that's committed to the database, it's associated with you. That's why I can click Meet Now, and their conference space is just available. It's like a virtual room in the sky, ready for me at any point in time. And it's very cool because at any point you can drag people in, you have a space to meet, to video, to collaborate. It's awesome. Here's the downside of that. It's always open. So if I have content up from one meeting, and then I slide right into the next meeting, that content is still there. The other thing is that when I have a meeting and I run long, as apparently I am now, the people joining the next call join in to the existing conference. So in that case, you might choose by policy or as a user to say, no, I want to have a new meeting space I'm going to create right here. And you have some options. You know, am I going to have announcements when people come in and go? Notice that callers get in directly is a set default. Part of that is because the join experience, if this isn't on a Link client and you have to use your 4x3 dial pad and you have to put a conference ID, then you fat-fingered it, so you do it a second time, then you do the PIN. That tends to be a little bit difficult, kind of an onerous process. So we'll let callers get right in, and part of the reason for that, from a security perspective, the way we view it, is that you've got so much of sensitive material that's presented visually, but on audio, no one can see that when they're in their car, right? So their ability is, rather than wait in a lobby and have to dial a bunch of digits, they're able to actually pass in. You can control presenter, some block attendee elements here, but the point is, this is what users have available to manage a meeting with the click of a button. And it's the sort of thing that we probably need to do a better job of educating our folks on so they can see that. Now, rather than get more into the user experience, there are some great things there to see. I want to make sure I'm able to get through as much of this as possible. So here we have, where am I at now? Oh, there's a clock. All right, service. Outlook reaches out to the focus factory. Focus factory, think of it not as a separate server, a logical entity that's going to generate a focus, which is a meeting instance for you. It does a policy check for you after somebody says, I want to create a meeting, sends back a 200 OK to your client, and now we're going to let Exchange know there's a meeting we've scheduled, and we want that in the calendar. Exchange is the only creature that knows anything about the meetings. Link doesn't know anything about when meetings take place. Meetings are always on, and meetings must be started by a person. There's no notion of anonymous. It's tied to you. It's tied to a person. You have to have an entity come in to light up the meeting. But once it's there, the time is now. The time is not later. Exchange is the only part of this ecosystem that understands the scheduling aspect. We've got some services that take place here. Schedule data stored in Exchange. You can use an add-in to modify the join bits. I didn't get to show you that there, but in the add-in, you're able to change legal disclaimer, put some verbiage down at the bottom. You can't automate that SL equals trick, but you can take care of some other, you can put a company logo in, for example, and put some a descriptive stuff at the bottom, confidentiality clauses and things like that. And we do have the ability to customize an invite. Slightly more now, actually I guess I do have these screenshots here for you. So what I just described, the bit there at the bottom, you can have a help URL, a legal text URL, logos, any sort of footer text, that you get to customize now in Link 2013, and it's there for all the users when they actually send an invite. This is the PowerShell version of it there, you can turn all of it on, it's exactly the same as what's in Control Panel with the exception of this one piece here that I thought I just highlighted, I did, whoops. Require room system authorization. That by default, that's set to false. The only room system conferences that require that are those that were set up as private. Otherwise, you can walk into a room system and away you go once you connect to the meeting. But as you can see, there's a lot of symmetry between Control Panel and the management shell for what you can govern. So this is just all about the meeting invite to make sure your users have something that makes sense when they actually send a meeting. The simple URLs. You know, in Topology Builder, I was talking about, hey, what happens if you have a lot of SIP domains? Well, all the way on the right is what can happen if you have a lot of SIP domains, and that's only mentioning two, right? Microsoft does things on the left. I've seen a lot of customers land in the middle. But when you end up on the right, you have lots of multiple domains. There's ways to try to get around additional SAN and DNS entries. The middle gets painful. So obviously, if you can condense your number of SIP domains as much as possible, that's certainly the best thing that you can do. I'm going to just build this entire slide out for you. But this is how we get from a conferencing, how we get to a conferencing scenario from simple URLs. So the simple URL is there at the top. We identify the SIP domain. Link figures out the organizer. It's able to find the conference ID. It's all there. From there, as we saw, it's going to actually reach out to the join launcher with that information and leverage this complicated SIP URI to kick off a meeting. A process goes like this, right? We have a simple request to DNS. All I know about is join Microsoft.com. It tells me, hey, you're either inside or outside, and here's the addresses and DNS entries you need to go to for that. I get the HTTP GET client tag again, so I can let the conferencing server know what my client runs, what it doesn't run. Am I a web client, right? Am I a full link user? At that point, then, I get the SIP URI, and I'm able to have a web join URL, and now my clients can connect. If it's a native client, it's joining the focus. If it's the web client, or if it's a mobile client, it's going to UCWA. They use a completely different experience and platform, which is lighter for them. Some PowerShell bits here about how to get how to set conferencing meeting experience. You know, you want to designate folks as a presenter, have people bypass the lobby. Those bits are there. I've got a couple more slides here. Let me build this one out and speak to it quickly here. Want to be sensitive to your time. Dial and join, very important scenario. Here's the media path, and what I want to highlight for you is that we have the user calling in. The user who set up this conference is in the pool in the bottom. The audio conferencing number, maybe they did what I just did. They said, hey, we have a lot of folks coming in from a different location. They're going to dial into that pool up at the top. So the call comes into the mediation server. Mediation server uses inbound routing to figure out where this conferencing server should end up. It sends the call to that pool that answers for that specific number. There's a conferencing URI lookup, conferencing ID lookup, and then we say, oh, the pool that's hosting this conference is this other pool down below. At that point, it's handled from within C3P, but we have Link doing effectively a transfer to the other pool, to the other focus, who then calls back to the mediation server and says, no, you've dialed over here, send me the media. This is where the conferencing media stream is going to come from, not that other pool that you called. They just had the answering number. And that's effectively what this is detailing here. This is why dial-in conferencing has to be set up well at the beginning, and you have to plan for it appropriately. The dial-out scenarios is very, very similar. Oh, I may have advanced that one too many. But it's a lot simpler in the sense that you've got users who say, hey, I need to get a call from this. I'm going to drag someone into a conference. They're on their cell phone far away. Link has to be able to leverage a mediation server, be able to get out to the PSTN, and it will dial that number. Similarly, if you have folks with a client that, say, call via work, they can even be reached by the mediation server, or they can use IP if they're, you know, if their 4G is solid enough or they're on a good data network, Wi-Fi, they're able to just do VoIP and video through the Link client natively. And again, that's the more modern clients here. These are some dial-out configuration specifics. There's a lot here to digest, but what I would probably spend the time on is this bit here, the notion of dial-in regional considerations. If you manage or are planning to manage regional conferencing, please understand, you gotta have a dial plan, right? And a dial plan is just a set of rules and normalization rules and dialing routes that are tied to a region. There's an access number, at least one. And you can have multiple access numbers, but each one access number will have display name, pool, all this information you see here, support for up to four languages. And that is how you're going to generate that. You're going to use that information in planning to generate your additional number call table, so that what we saw in that upper right hand where I was able to say, hey, if I need other dial-in numbers, how do I find that? All this planning has to take place before you move forward. So you try to create a geographic region with multiple languages. You try to create recognizable names to keep it simple. You can even use this PowerShell commandlet to prioritize one number over the rest. Please, this is a hard, hard slide to read. All I would say is encourage your conferencing users to do voice via Link clients. I slowed that down to an almost painful degree here, but the reality is if you think about dialing the digits for the conference, dialing the digits for the conference ID. Are you a user or are you the leader? Yes, press 1. Enter your PIN. That's a lot of dialing. By the time you're done, you look like the dude in the upper right. And so I think the notion here is that we have some things here that are best practices when you're trying to get away from a traditional ACP experience and you want to bypass lobbies and things like that. But at the end of the day, the best experience is going to be from a Link client. Lastly, and there's only 3 slides left. We've got a lot of tools here to help out. I'm going to stop at this point with building the slide, but we've got capacity planning guide, which is going to basically take a look at the different types of personas that you can have in your organization, user models, if you will, a bandwidth calculator that then allows you to plan for what network locations you have that could be impacted by those personas, a capacity calculator who's going to basically help you plan for actual specs on a server, disk, RAM, processor, and then stress performance. This is actually a tool very similar to what we use internally that allows you to run it against your pilot environment. So before you launch, you can know that you've actually built something that will withstand the rigors of actual use. You then progress into rollout, and then we have monitor and maintain. Honestly, this is just built as a circle because after I don't know how many years of consulting and unified communications, what we find is an iterative process. You've gone through all this work, and then your company acquires a new business in South America, and you have to do it all over again, or the business model changes, or new services, and you have to do all this again. Use these tools. The deck is going to be available for you online, and use that model. Be very, very careful. So if I was to leave you with a go-do, it's to light up your conferencing. And specifically what we're talking about is you plan it, using the tools, you build it, paying very special attention to your simple URLs, your archiving elements, things like that. Dial-in, you plan for. You plan for that, you plan for dial-out, and then you start to enable your conferencing and manage this as you go. You measure, then start to refine and cut, and finally, when you feel like you've got it right, you extend it out to the rest of the organization. So that was a tremendous amount of information. in a very short period of time, but I am here, actually probably not a short enough period of time, but I am here to answer any questions afterwards. I'll also provide my email address. If you have any questions at all afterwards, I want to follow up and make sure you feel set up to go from clicking join to explaining this or defining this and building this yourself. So thank you for your time. I believe there's an eval process I'm supposed to remind you of. So my apologies for being late, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.